Today on Against the Grain, how should we understand the ecological crisis accelerating around us? In a book that has sparked debate on the European left, Ulrich Brandt and Markus Wissen trace the origins of the Western mode of production and living, which is now spreading around the world. They connect such resource and emissions-intensive consumption to the political instability of our times and point to alternatives beyond capitalism. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. It's hardly revelatory to point out that the kind of consumption typical of wealthy countries like the United States isn't sustainable, based as it is on the massive use of resources and the massive generation of emissions. But that often leads to the conclusion that as individuals, we need to make different lifestyle choices. My guest today, however, argues that we need to look at the way we live through the lens of capitalism as an economic system and the particular relationship that it has fostered between the global north and the global south. Ulrich Brandt is professor at the University of Vienna and co-author with Markus Wissen of The Imperial Mode of Living, Everyday Life and the Ecological Crisis of Capitalism, published by Verso. Uli, your argument revolves around the idea of an imperial mode of living. Can you first define what a mode of living is for us, and then what makes it imperial in this particular case?
We understand a mode of living, a difference as a lifestyle. A lifestyle is something that we can observe, that people choose something, a certain car, a certain home, a certain customs of traveling, of eating, and so on. And the mode of living is more the structure, how people overall live, how they consume, how they commute, how their mobility, the food system. So the mode of living is, in a general way, how people reproduce their everyday lives through consumptions, but also through work. And this is produced. Yeah, the cars are not only used, but we need an infrastructure for the cars. We need a production system, a globalized economy to get the materials for the cars, etc., etc. This is, if you like, the pattern, the dominant pattern of production and consumption is indicated as a mode of living. And then, of course, there are also alternatives. And we add the term imperial to indicate that these normalized everyday patterns of production and consumption in the US, in Europe, and elsewhere is based in principle on an unlimited appropriation of resources and labor capacity of both the global north and the global south. So if people use in their everyday life a cell phone, or if they eat meat and this meat is produced, or the animals are raised with soybean from Brazil, they have this access to resources, to labor capacity from China in the case of the cell phone, or to Brazil in the case of soybean.
How does looking at things through the lens of an imperial mode of living help us understand the multiple crises that we're experiencing? We could list a whole number of them: political, social, ecological, etc.
First of all, we want to emphasize that the mode of living invisibilizes and normalizes the violent character of the capitalist mode of production and living. So first of all, our argument is that it's not present, that people live their everyday lives, not because they are bad or they have bad intentions, but this is the reproduction of the everyday life. But in principle, global capitalism is highly violent, is exploiting nature, exploiting people, etc., etc. And that people are forced into this mode of living, into these patterns of production and consumption, because they are in a subaltern status. They have to sell their labor power, they have to consume at an everyday level. Of course, they have some choices, but in principle, they are part of this mode of living. We started to reflect and to develop the concept not by chance in the crisis of 2007 and 2008. And Markus and I, we work in globalization studies. We are political activists, and we are in the social ecological movements and debates. And we asked ourselves why, despite the high politicization of the climate crisis, of the ecological crisis, the high politicization of North-South relations and polarization, why crisis policies at this time were stabilizing the existing economy. For us, the best example in Europe were the so-called scrapping bonuses, that the state, the governments, gave the car holders in Germany 2,500 euros, in Austria 2,000 euros, to give up the existing car, to scrap it, to let it scrap, to buy a new one, in order to stabilize the automotive industry and the automotive system. So then our argument is that in a moment of crisis, the 2007-2008 crisis, the crisis mechanisms are in a sense stabilizing the traditional, or if you like, the dominant economy, but at the cost of deepening the ecological crisis, and not taking seriously this politicization, or this, if you like, an obvious need for action to counter the ecological crisis. So we argue that the multiple crises, the crisis of the economic crisis, the crisis of reproduction, the crisis of democracy and representation, if you like, but also the ecological crisis, are interlinked, but we have to look very carefully how specific crisis policies, if you like, to rescue the economy, now the same in the coronavirus crisis, we will come back to this probably, how certain policies to stabilize the economy, to stabilize the mode of living of everyday people, of the ordinary people in their everyday lives, is taking place at the cost of nature, at the cost of a further destruction of the environment.
And following the crisis that you just mentioned, the global financial crisis of 2007-2008, instead of a shift toward addressing the ecological crisis, we have seen instead different other patterns of trying to shore up the system, as well as the rise of the far right in places like Germany, where you come from, like in the US, in Brazil. How do you understand the rise of the far right in the context of the way you see it through this lens of an unsustainable mode of living in particularly or especially the global north?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a very interesting question. We would argue that the dealing with the crisis of the dominant forces, the crisis of 2007-2008, but also, if you like, the so-called refugee crisis or the refugee movement from 2015, take place under the control of dominant forces, and the neoliberal globalized economy and the related power relations are not questioned. The polarization, the social polarization, increases. People live in fear. People are put to live in fear. That in Germany, for example, the flexibilization of the labor market, the labor market reforms by the red-green government 20 years ago, the so-called Hartz reforms, put people much more at risk to be unemployed and to fall out of the system. This produces fear, and this is one aspect that the far right proposes or also tells the people. So if you vote for us, we will try to get to reorganize our societies, because there is one cause of the uneasiness, one cause of the problems, which are the refugees, which are the foreigners, which is the globalization process, which is China. So one aspect of the crisis is that the responses to crisis, usually there are responses, but usually take place within a neoliberal frame. And then from our perspective and with our lens, we would argue that the far right, and Trump is probably the best example, and also George Bush Sr. During the Gulf War in the 90s, when he said during the war, the declaration of the New World Order, when he was at the Rio conference in 92, when he said, yeah, we need global environmental politics, but the American way of life is not at disposal. Yeah, and the New World Order is under the dominance of the United States. So in our words, the far right is defending, protecting the imperial mode of living. This is the promise, of course, in other words. Yeah, but this is the promise, and it is kind of fertile on a field which is neoliberalized, where people have fear and others. But we would go a step further. We would argue it's the far right, but it's far throughout society that, of course, then with other demands, with other claims, the imperial mode of living is defended. So, for example, and this is from a progressive perspective, very, very ambiguous and a challenge, if you like, that the trade unions, in fact, are also, if it comes to to defending jobs, defending the industries in the global north, are also protecting, if you like, in a sense, the imperial mode of living and saying, okay, we want imports of certain products, but the high productivity, the core industry remains in the global north. So, again, not with the term of imperial mode of living, but we have also among conservative, liberal, and even social democratic forces, a reference to the imperial mode of living to defend it I leave it here.
Well, spell out a bit more about the supposed alternative to the far right, which is has sometimes been termed progressive neoliberalism or multicultural neoliberalism, that defends globalization of free markets, you know, in contrast to at least part of the right. What sort of alternative, if any, is offered by this kind of neoliberalism?
Yeah, there is an alternative in the sense that they are globalized, that they are cosmopolitan, if you like, in a cultural sense, that they are open. It's not only an elite orientation, also, if you like, the middle classes, the upper middle classes, can live well in the under conditions of progressive neoliberalism and respective policies, and even workers, if they have a decent life, a decent income, they can live better, and maybe they are not attracted by nationalist or far-right ideologies. But our argument would be precisely that also progressive neoliberalism is defending the imperial mode of living. It's not questioning a form of to reproduce societies, to have policies, to create forms of mobility, yeah? Automobile-centric, flight-centric, to have a certain global food system, which Philip McMichael, the sociologist, calls the food from nowhere. Yeah, that it doesn't matter where the food comes from, it must be cheap and good and available. So we would argue that the free market globalist perspective is also promoting an imperial mode of living with other means, with other instruments, with other world perspectives, but it's not as liberal as it pretends to be. It's also reproducing the violence of globalized capitalism. It's reproducing that people in Bangladesh or in Mexico have to work at very, very under very bad working conditions, that nature and the resources are extracted and over-extracted and brought into the global north, or via China, where the products are produced and then they are exported to the global north. So, of course, there is a difference between progressive neoliberalism and the far right, but if we look at from an angle of the imperial mode of living, there are also many similarities.
Yes, yeah, so just to draw it out, so you're arguing that for the far right, they want to defend the imperial mode of living as is, and that for that so-called progressive neoliberalism, that they recognize there's a crisis, but their answer is to just sort of modernize the imperial mode of living. Tell us what that looks like.
Yeah, we distinguish in debates on how to deal with the ecological crisis. We can distinguish between a position of business as usual, which is close to the far right or to the ultra neoliberals, and progressive neoliberalism would consider and would recognize, as you say, the ecological crisis and other dimensions of the crisis, and they would say, okay, we need to modernize capitalism or the economy. They don't usually not the concept of capitalism. We need green growth, not the traditional growth. We need a modernization of the fleet. We need automobility. We need other sources beyond the fossil fuel energy, etc., etc. And so they have more the idea to change the society and not to leave it as it is. This is the difference to the far right, but as not questioning the imperial mode of living. To give you an example, if now the debate on social ecological transformation or the Green New Deal, which is the more the political term, is, of course, there are many proposals to have more public investment, to have a stronger role of the state, to have more renewable energies. But if it does not go so far to question the working conditions, the north-south relations, where the resources come from, when this is not questioned, the imperial mode of living is maintained, and at the same time, it's of course, it's modernized. And I would like to come back to one thought and one question of you before. Our book, unconsciously, this was not our intention, but when the book came out, one contribution, one important contribution was in Germany, in Austria, to intervene into a very, very important split within the left. I don't know how is it in the United States or in Canada, but in Europe, the split which goes through the left is to have more an internationalist position, and to really rethink how the global economy, how resource flows are organized. But we have also a very strong position. Sarah Wagenknecht in Germany is an important figure for this, to argue if we are too open, if we are too cosmopolitan, if we are, if you like, too progressive, and we overburden ordinary people, and we risk maybe their jobs. So we have to act primarily at the national level and to defend social rights at the national level and not to think too global. Because if we don't do it, people might vote for the far right, for the AfD in Germany, for the FPÖ in Austria. So there is no clear-cut solution, but we found it quite interesting that when we got the feedback on the German publication, many says, okay, these two authors, Ulrich Brandt and Markus Wissen, are very much in this line of new internationalism, to rethink the ecological crisis or to consider the depths of the ecological crisis. And others argue, but you are downplaying, you are forgetting that we have also in Germany a deep crisis. And if we don't deal with it at the national scale, we will lose people and they will vote for the far right.
And I want to ask you more about that line of criticism in a moment, but I should say that I'm speaking with Ulrich Brandt. He's professor at the University of Vienna, and he's the co-author with Markus Wissen of The Imperial Mode of Living, Everyday Life and the Ecological Crisis of Capitalism, which is published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So one of the criticisms that was leveled at your book when it came out, which prompted a great deal of response from those within the left, but one criticism centered around this question of class and posited that you create the danger of, when talking about an imperial mode of living in the North, of lumping the CEO of a northern multinational corporation with its workers. In other words, that by seeing things primarily in terms of the global North and the global South and the mode of living in the global North, that it erases or obscures the class divisions that are so pronounced in the global North. How do you respond to that criticism?
This was a strong criticism, and we were surprised, because we are quite explicit in the book that, of course, the imperial mode of living is a structural category of to indicate the dominant patterns of production and consumption and their normalization, the invisibilization of the violence caused by the production of cars, of cell phones, of t-shirts, of meat, etc., etc. But you are right, the book was perceived by many as a North-South book. And since we are recognized and known in the German-speaking world as internationalists, and of course we wrote also other stuff, people might have put the emphasis on that. However, this is not the case. We want to bring into the debate the North-South dimension, but we are very explicit, and in further work we even deepened this argument. But I would say also in the book we are very explicit that, and we call it hierarchization when we call about the mechanisms of the imperial mode of living, that the imperial mode of living historically, since colonialism if you like, is based on class structures, is based on racism. We call it also La colonialidad de poder, the coloniality of power, with Aníbal Quijano. It's based also on a gendered division of labor, of a gendered social structure. But we focus on class, and we argue that with the term of elsewhere, that people live better in Berlin, in Vienna, in New York, in the Bay Area, not only because they can consume products and services produced in the global south or with a cheap nature, but also produced in their own country. If we think of care work, if we think of conditions, the working conditions in meat factories or elsewhere, this is also a precondition of the imperial mode of living. So we have this double perspective, if you like, and we were a bit surprised. And maybe this has to do that half a year before us, another scholar, Stefan Lessenich, a sociologist from Munich, published a book very close to our topic. We know each other quite well, and he focuses very much in the tradition of dependency theory on the North-South relation. And he says, in a sense, if the water glass is fuller in the North, it's more empty in the global South. And we try to avoid this argument with many, many examples, but also with our point. The hierarchization, the class structure, is the basis of the imperial mode of living, and the imperial mode of living is reproducing, is prolonging certain class structures.
Sure, and of course, the countries of the global South are themselves also divided by class and quite different from one another. You have some like China that are economic powerhouses, and others like Bolivia that are sites of tremendous resource extraction. And then obviously there are class divisions within the countries of the South, the global South, including countries like India, where you have a substantial middle as well as upper class that consumes in patterns that are very reminiscent of the northern mode of living. How do you make sense of these differences, and how do you see that imperial mode of living being relevant to the more affluent in the global South?
Yeah, this is a central topic for us. We argue, I come back to the question of the affluence, that since the colonialism, the imperial mode of living is very present, even colonialism is to install the imperial mode of living. And the changes within society, I work and I do research on Latin America. Yeah, I'm quite familiar with what is happening there. And colonialism changed much more the societies in the global south, in the colonies, than in the capitalist centers. Yeah, there it was at the beginning for centuries a question of state resources, of the upper classes, etc. But it was really changing social structures and killing many people in the global south. And coming back to your question, we have a chapter on China. And we and of course, there are many, many references to Latin America. And we argue exactly like this. And this is very uncomfortable. When we present the book and give talks in Latin America, that the urban middle classes and the affluent, the oligarchy, of course, but then also the urban middle classes, are living in the imperial mode of living. If they increase their income, it's very attractive to buy a car, to have more travels, etc., etc. And this is also a topic especially for the so-called emerging economies. There's a very interesting concept recently developed by two younger colleagues from Jena, from the University of Jena, Anna Landher and Jakob Graf, and they say, and working on Chile, the complement of the externalization mechanisms of the global north within the imperial mode of living is the internalization society of the global south. They say the dependency of the world market, but also the dependency of certain images of progress, of well-being, of the American way of life, very present in Latin America, of course, is stabilizing class structures, is stabilizing property relations, because the state in Chile, the discourses of progress, or in Brazil and Argentina and elsewhere, is saying, okay, we have the chance, if we are a dependent economy, but we can export copper, we can export fruits, etc., to the United States and elsewhere. And so we will have development, and with the development, everybody will live better off. And this is also for the upper middle classes a real experience. If the prices are higher, if the demand from the world market, from China, the US and Europe, is higher for the commodities on the global south, there is more income, there is more space for the state to distribute the rents, and this is also then the experience of an imperial mode of living. And I would say, and this is also maybe a success of our book, it's translated now into Chinese, Korean, Japanese, but also it just came out in Portuguese and Spanish, and that it helps to understand that it's not only about US imperialism or European imperialism. It's not only about transnational companies. It's not only about the own oligarchy. Of course, it's also very much about this, but it's also about a reproduction of a mode of living. It's a reproduction of certain dispositifs of, if you like, attractive understandings where society should develop to. And to close this remark, we think that one of the causes, one of the reasons why this book was so successful for the moment in the German-speaking world is that we don't moralize. We criticize the very strong direction, the very strong tendency within sustainability studies to individualize responsibility, to say the end consumer is the main responsible, and if he or she goes green, everything will be fine. Yeah. So it's a very strong discourse of the green economy, of the sustainability discourse to say, okay, the consumer is who takes the last decision. And we say, no, it's about structures. It's about capitalism. It's about capitalist power relations. And this non-moralizing, yeah, I want to emphasize that, of course, there is we should be conscious about our own living and about the possibilities where we can really go for alternatives. But we cannot say to ordinary people, so go for green consumption, and this will resolve the problems. And this no moralizing is probably one of the strengths of the book.
Yes, and that moralism is also very strong, I think, in the environmental movement and even on the left in the United States, that places where you see uneven development and the uneven distribution of resources, that things ended up being put at the feet of people as individuals. And therefore, the politics moves away from the structural critique of capitalism to questions of individual consumption. I wanted to ask you also about how, when you look at the imperial mode of living in the global north, but as you say, with its sort of deep ramifications for the global south, how do you also understand waged and unwaged work? This question of social reproduction, which is a question that Marxist feminists particularly highlight, about the necessity of unwaged work for the reproduction of capitalism, including consumption.
Yes, we highlight this in the book quite strongly, and we discussed the manuscript with feminist colleagues from feminist economics and feminist social science in advance. We had some workshops where the manuscripts were discussed, and I think this is, from our perspective, quite strong. It's not a feminist book, but it's a book which takes seriously the intersectionality of domination of power relations and power structures. And we argue, if you like, historically with Rosa Luxemburg, who argued capitalism needs non-capitalist milieus, needs for its own reproduction spaces that are non-waged, which is nature as a gratis a productive force, but it's also unwaged labor, and unwaged labor is mainly done by women, even more women in the global south. So I think this is quite strong, and we would argue that the imperial mode of living is not only the formal economy. The formal economy gives the dynamics, but it needs these gratis, unpaid productive force, which is female labor, which is nature. And when we come afterwards to alternatives, we think it's crucial to have this in mind and to question a bit this focus of many leftist forces that it's about the change of wage labor, the working class, and the organized forces. And we argue, no, a deep change of the mode of living has a lot to do with everyday practices, and also the question of justice comes through everyday practices, and then we are in the mid of the fear of reproduction.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'm speaking with the co-author of The Imperial Mode of Living, Everyday Life and the Ecological Crisis of Capitalism. That's published by Verso. And I'm speaking with Ulrich Brandt. He is the co-author with Marcus Wissen of this book, as well as The Limits to Capitalist Nature. Both are scholar activists. So I wanted to turn and ask you about the historical origins of the imperial mode of living. When would you date its emergence and what forces led to it?
In debates about the book, many say the imperial mode of living already was a part of the Roman Empire. Yeah, because the Roman Empire was also imperial, and it was an empire, it was quite imperial. And we say, yes, this is true, but since it's a book about capitalism, and to understand better the capitalist structures and capitalist dynamics, we start more modestly, if you like, with colonialism, with the conquest of South America. And we argue that at the very beginning, in the 16th, 17th century, it was crucial, and then with slave trade from Africa to the Americas, it was crucial to link the world under the main interest, under the main dynamics of capitalism, which is the accumulation of capital, which is to produce surplus value and to make profits. Very, very simple. But to use, also, if necessary, open violence. Yeah, capitalism is not a peaceful thing. If it's necessary, until today we know this, slavery is part of global capitalism. Then we argue that in the 18th century, with the expansion of capitalism, with the first steps, if you like, of industrial capitalism, the imperial mode of living entered slowly into the societies of the global north. As I said before, it was always very, very present in the colonies, in the societies of the global south, but it entered into the societies of the global north and became also attractive among the upper classes, the upper middle classes. If you go to Vienna, you have the coffee houses, you have these experiences of people who had money to distinguish themselves from the workers via certain products and to live better off. But also, there is this fantastic study from James Walvin on the global history of sugar. Also, we can show that sugar is a very important product for energy for the workers who had to go to the factories and to make their living and to live and to get the energy. And it's only two chapters, and we are not historians, it's not a historical book, but we want to make the argument also to look at history. And then we come to a phase which for us is crucial in the constitution of the imperial mode of living and in the constitution of the problems we have today, which we call in critical social science Fordism, or the post-war period, which means that after the Second World War, starting in the United States already in the 1920s, that mass production, mass consumption, aspects of the welfare state of and also of an interventionist state, yeah, which is not what is not any longer liberal capitalism with a weak state, but the state really intervened into the economy. Yeah, the New Deal from Roosevelt, for example. In this phase, and this is also for progressive forces very ambiguous, in this phase, the living standard of people, also the security of people in their everyday life with more permanent contracts, with a good representation via the trade unions, etc., etc., improved incredibly in the first time of history. My parents, yeah, lived so differently from their parents from the 50s and 60s onwards. This is what we call, yeah, Fordism, or the golden age of capitalism, but with all problems. The problems were that it was patriarchal, it was racist, it was very uneven in the north-south relations, and it was also ecologically very destructive. So what we call the Great Acceleration, it was the term coined by Will Stefan and others, the Great Acceleration means that since the 1950s, all the indicators, GDP, population growth, but also the use of resources, the use of energy, goes up heavily. And this is the cause of the environmental problems we are facing today. So we argue the imperial mode of living has a long history, but it comes to itself, if you like, in the post-war period as the first phase. The second phase, we argue, is in the 90s. The so-called third phase of globalization. The first phase of globalization was in the 70s, the opening of the markets, the financial markets, the commodity markets. The second phase was the fall of the Berlin Wall, the opening of Eastern Europe, and the third phase of globalization in the 90s, of course, is the rise of China, India, the emerging economies. And if we look at the numbers of material use, of energy use since the 90s, and particularly since the 2000s, during this phase of globalization, the global resource use explodes. And again, this leads to an enormous increase of the of the living standards of many people in China, India, Brazil, etc., etc. But again, at the cost of nature, at the cost of emissions, the greenhouse gas emissions, but also, and this is very important from a progressive perspective, the imperial mode of living as a structure does not give people so many alternatives. They are forced to live in the imperial mode of living. This is the ambiguous thing. We come from a Marxist tradition, so we think in contradictions, in ambiguities, and we argue, of course, the imperial mode of living is enhancing the life chances of a people, but at the same time, it restricts alternative because people are kind of forced into a specific mobility system to use a car. If you live in the United States, in many, many places, you need a car because you don't have public transport. You are within the system, and it's difficult to overcome it.
I wanted to ask you a bit more about the trajectory you were describing of the rise of the imperial mode of living, its intensification with Fordism in the post-war period, especially in the 50s, 60s, 70s. But then Fordism came to a crisis. You know, you were describing how during that time, unions were strong and consumption went up. And then you described in the 1990s another expansion of consumption. But I wanted to ask you if you could spell out for us what happened there, because of course there was a weakening of labor, the power of labor, especially in a place like the United States, but you know, even in throughout Europe. What allowed for the second phase of the expansion of this mode of living, given that in many places wages were falling and the power of labor was weakened?
This is an important point, and I have two answers. The first is that we argue in the book that at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s, there was a window of opportunity to create alternatives to the imperial mode of living. If we think about the hippie movement, the ecological movement, the peace movement, the feminist movements, the questioning of the everyday discipline of Fordism to wake up in the morning, to go to the factory, to have one job during the whole life, etc., etc. So we don't romanticize it. We know that it was at the edges of the societies, but it was a very relevant change. We call it window of opportunity until the 70s. But then in the crisis of Fordism, which was also caused by these movements, not only by the decrease of productivity and of profits, the answer of dominant forces was neoliberalism. It was precisely to weaken the alternative forces and to weaken also those who represent the workers, the trade unions. And so aspects of these liberation movements, of the social movements, were also integrated into neoliberalism via more flexibilization, to have more self-control, to have more self-discipline and not so much the discipline coming from outside. But we would argue, and this is important for today, that we can learn from this time for today how a new imaginary, a new self-understanding of society can emerge in a moment of crisis. We shouldn't remember that already at the beginning of the 70s, with the Club of Rome, Limits to Growth study, but also with the environmental movement, with the critique of nuclear power plants, etc., etc. There was also a critique of how society deals with the environment, how society appropriates nature, that this is in a very destructive way. And today we have, in some respects, a similar constellation. The second aspect of your question is that we argue, again, not consciously, but as an ambiguity of the existing, that the imperial mode of living, in a moment when the income of the workers decreases, when the living conditions of the workers are worsened, that the imperial mode of living at least in parts helped to stabilize the living conditions. So Walmart, if you like, is securing a certain living standard of people who are losing income, who are worse off when it comes to income and the job, but the access to global resources, to global labor force, which makes the products cheaper, helps a bit to stabilize the reproduction of the workers. So, but it's very important. We don't argue that people want this consciously. This comes back to our structural perspective. But people are caught into this. So if Walmart produces 80% of its products in China, this is not the decision of the consumers. This is a profit-oriented capitalist decision to make more profits when we go to China.
Ulrich Brand is my guest. He is the co-author with Marcus Vissen of The Imperial Mode of Living, Everyday Life, and the Ecological Crisis of Capitalism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. But let me ask you then, springboarding from your comments about how in the crisis of Fordism in the 1970s, this crisis of capitalism, which was also a crisis for workers, that there were some openings or moments or prefiguration of what alternatives to the dominant mode of living, this resource and emissions intensive mode of consumption in the global north, that alternatives appeared that might inspire different ways of living. And you and your co-author Marcus Vissen in your book do talk about ways of overcoming this imperial mode, drawing on sort of more utopian strains than, as earlier you mentioned, the way that neoliberalism would shore up the imperial mode. This is a question of overcoming it. And you explicitly reject green capitalism, which seems finally on offer in a place like the United States. What instead do you think would show itself as having the potential for a different mode of living that would not be based on these deep inequalities between global north and south, as well as within the global north and within the global south?
Yes, I think this is a very, very important argument in our book, to reject the promise of green capitalism, or the formal term, of course, is green economy. Nobody identifies itself as a green capitalist, but to push the green economy, to push the European Green Deal, which is very different from the Green New Deal by Ocasio-Cortez and others. So our point is coming from also from a tradition by Antonio Gramsci, thinking how consent is created within society, and the imperial mode of living is very crucial to this, but also how the powerful forces are responding to crisis and to crises. And we argue with a term developed by Gramsci, with a passive revolution. A passive revolution means that the elites see the problems. They see today the ecological crisis, but they respond in their terms. And in their term means green investment, a green state, without questioning the imperial mode of living, without questioning the growth imperative, without questioning the global competitiveness and global competition, without questioning the North-South divide, and without questioning the class structures within the US and around the world. So, but this is a very powerful discourse. It's not the business as usual discourse. It's not the far right discourse, just let it be as it was, but we have to change capitalism. And if we look at the studies, Marcus and I work on this, on transformation, the elites are very conscious about the deep problems we are in. When you go through the program of the European Green Deal, the mostly used word is transform, to transform, yeah, the transformation. So they have a sense of the deep crisis of capitalism, but they say, we know how to respond. And this is our response is green growth, green investment, etc. And we argue, and our term in the eighth chapter of the book is a solidary mode of living, yeah, against the imperial mode of living, that it must go beyond capitalism. Of course, in a sense, as a strategic horizon, that we shouldn't claim, okay, tomorrow now we are anti-capitalist, everybody, and we overrule capitalism or go away. But to orient struggles, the concrete struggles against pipelines, for another energy system, for another mobility system, for another food system, how these very concrete conflicts and struggles have a potential to go beyond the profit orientation, beyond the growth orientation, and beyond, and this is heavy, beyond power relations. So fossil fuel capital is still extremely powerful, much more in the United States than in Europe. And our point is first to look at these very concrete conflicts, to make sense of them and to ask always, not from outside, not as academics, but in the struggles itself, how we can identify the danger of a green capitalism, yeah, to be co-opted. Many struggles are co-opted. How to resist to this co-option, and then how to go beyond. The second is, coming back to the 70s, neoliberalism's promise was that the market, that private capital, is better than the state and the public. And our argument is no. What we even learn now in the coronavirus crisis, we need a strong state, a transparent, public, democratically responsible state, not the state of capital, but a state of people, which secures the public, which secures the living conditions of the everyday, which secures public transport, a good health system, a good educational system, which is a second aspect. And a third aspect, our argument is not to do less of the same, to praise individual abstinence, but to create something differently, which is, I think, very, very important. Degrowth does not mean we go back to 2005, yeah, and then we have less resource consumption, but to really fight for a very different system of mobility, of communication, of food, etc., etc.
Do you see social movements that in some ways are prefiguring the kind of changes that you see? Because as you just mentioned, the kind of politics that shaped around the idea that we just need to scale back our standard of living can be pretty problematic in societies that may be wealthy, but in which there are people who really struggle to get by, to pay the rent, to be able to get by from month to month. And so as a vision for the left, for many people, that's not particularly appealing. Are there other movements that you see that prefigure what you're talking about, something different, something to, if you'll excuse the term, transformative?
Yes, I see them. And to get to the point, our point is, yes, to scale back a standard of living means to change a standard of living and hopefully not to be dependent from your income, from the money flow. If you have in the Bay Area a good, affordable, secure public transport system and people can avoid to have a car, so they avoid to have $300 income per month or how much it is in the Bay Area, and to have a good and reliable public transport. This means if it's publicly organized, not to be any longer capitalist in a very concrete sense. And if you go to a health system, if you don't have to put your credit card on the counter to get a health service, but to have a good public health system organized by a state in a transparent way, this means not to be dependent, not to save money for the case that I get ill. People who struggle should, of course, have a decent life and have a decent income, yeah, without any question. But another society should overcome the dependency of people and the dependency of a good living from the income, because this is capitalism. Yeah? So what are the public provisions? What are the good conditions of a solidary mode of living? So our idea of action is not the individual action of a different consumption, but it's a political action to create the very conditions of the health system, of the mobility system, of the food system. And a brief remark on countries of the global south, because we are always asked and criticized, hey folks, maybe degrowth is valuable for the global north or the solidarity mode of living, but in the global south, people are poor and need education and water, so they have to grow. And our answer is, and again, I work on Latin America, no, the conditions of development in the global south are exploitative, capitalist, oligarchic, and they are a promise, but they promise the people become part of the capitalist market, become part of capitalist consumerism when you are in the middle class in Sao Paulo or in Buenos Aires. And we would also argue Buenos Aires, Sao Paulo, Mexico City, but also the countryside, also needs good public transport, also needs a good health system. And the promise in those countries is very often from the liberals and the right wing forces. So we need development that people have more income. And the leftist answer would be and is, of course, in Latin America and elsewhere, no, we need a reconstitution of society to be less dependent from income flows, from money, etc., etc. And the first part of your question, where I see the social movements, I would argue, yes, if the social movements, for example, we have in Vienna a very interesting movement, which is called System Change, Not Climate Change, which is exactly questioning, and Vienna, the Red Vienna, has a long tradition of a good public transport system, but the dominance, the predominance of the cars in Vienna is stupid. It's incredible that the local state, the national state, the whole mobility system is still privileging cars in a city as Vienna. So the movements, the radical movements say, what is a city liberated from cars, liberated from the force to have a car, from the status orientation to have a car? So these movements, I would say, are part of this, of an emerging solidary mode of living. A last remark. We would, we focus very much on social movements as incubators, as very important agents of a different society. But we also would argue that the state, as I said, a democratic, transparent, popular state, with its resources, with its legal capacities, with its knowledge capacities, is key to create a solidary mode of living. So we would not go only for social movements. They are so very important, but we think we should also, and let's say the scale of change, the scale of transformation is so huge, is so immense, that we cannot afford to say, okay, the state is just the state of the capitalists, the state of the oligarchy. We need a struggle on the terror of the state, and lastly, also on the terror of the very economy.
Ulrich Brand, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. This was a great conversation. Thank you, Sasha.
Ulrich Brand is co-author with Markus Wissen of The Imperial Mode of Living, Everyday Life and the Ecological Crisis of Capitalism, which is published by Verso. Both were active in the global justice movement and currently with the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, and they're both co-authors of The Limits to Capitalist Nature. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.